Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
The following is an installment of Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
Do you remember your very first job?
My very first job was putting the price tags on Pampers at Kmart.
You're kidding.
In Salem, New Hampshire. I wanted to have a job because I wasn't getting an allowance. So my mommy taught me how to look in the newspaper, which I did, and Kmart had a posting. So I went down and I had an interview with a very nice lady, and I had to fill out an application, which I did, and I got the job. I think they pretty much hired everybody, and they knew it was my first job, so they were going to give me a chance. I lasted 2 weeks at this job. Apparently, what I did was I was putting the medium-sized Pampers price tag on the large. The company probably lost about 12 cents in revenue due to me. And the lady who hired me for my first job, who was very nice, was very angry. She was like a dragon lady when she had to give me the stern lecture. And sorry, we don't allow that in our store. And actually, I thought I was going into the office because they were going to give me a raise, because I heard about work and how they give you raises from minimum wage real fast. And I was wrong. I was fired.
And all you did was put the wrong price tags on the wrong Pampers.
Well, also I would talk to my coworkers.
Oh, okay. See, there is something more.
I was probably sitting down a lot. I was probably associating with my coworkers and cutting up. I was trying to make the hours more enjoyable by becoming the star of the diaper aisle. It was very demeaning to be fired from your first job. It was psychological abuse. Why am I not good enough to work here? I established friendships, I had connection, and now I'm just being cut. And for the most part, this is like dying. The woman doesn't even care that she's like killing me, because I'm not even allowed back in the store. I've been disgraced. I've lost face, as the Japanese say. And I have to go home and explain it to my parents that I'm a loser. And it was so damaging that it carried me for the rest of my work life. I remember actually writing a list of all the jobs I've had in my life and all the jobs I've been fired from, which were about 95% of them. I worked over 100 jobs. I am the record holder of jobs you got fired from.
A few days after I record my friend Peter Choice telling his story about the diaper job, I meet with my friend Nick for lunch. Nick does a lot of freelancing for magazines, and so, like me, he has his afternoons free. You see, this is one of the main problems with my doing a series of radio programs on work. Sure, like Peter, I've had my share of crappy jobs, but I can't compete with his 100. In fact, it's kind of ridiculous for me to pretend that I have anything meaningful to say about work. I've never even had a real 9-to-5, ever. Really, I know nothing about the pain and humiliation of cubicles or office microwaves. I have no great insights into the pained, blank expressions of the people I see slumped on buses and subways. Of course, I assume it has something to do with the fact that they are aware of just how much they're missing out on, and just how much of their lives are being utterly wasted. But it doesn't take much to see this, which is why most of us choose to look away. It's just too awful. the expression of a man who's aware that he spent the last 10 years of his life maintaining a database that tracks underwear trends, or the expression of a woman going over and over again in her head the justifications as to why she needs to spend 9 hours in a cubicle, pretending to look busy while her son discovers winter, spring, summer, fall. Nick and I are meeting for lunch to discuss how much one of the magazines he works for will pay me to come and teach them about podcasting. It's a ludicrous amount, and I can't stop snorting into my whiskey sour every time he brings it up. Then his cell phone rings. "Excuse me," he says after checking the caller ID. "I have to take this. It's one of the editors at the magazine." Now, the worst thing about sitting next to someone who's having a cell phone conversation is when you can hear the person on the other end. I actually enjoy overhearing one-way conversations because then I get to make up what the other person is saying.
"What's up?"
"I'm cybering with some chick I met on Craigslist."
"Did you remember to pick up the roast beef?"
"I only left the house today to go buy crack."
"Great, so I have to go out of my way now?"
"Oh, a whole extra block. You can use the exercise, you fat cow."
Okay, I guess you're right. "Did you at least pay the singular bill?"
"No, I told you. I bought crack."
"Really?"
"Yep. And I got head, too."
"Really?"
"Yeah. The crack guy had this girl who needed $20.
"Really?"
"Oh, if only you had a mouth like that."
"Well, I'm still on the bus."
"I know. I can hear the lady sitting across from you praying to the Blessed Virgin for you to spontaneously combust."
"Really?"
"Actually, she's praying for you to get throat cancer."
"Can you make sure the TiVo is set to record 24 tonight?"
"How many times do I have to spell it out for you? If I need something done, then you do it. And if you need something done, you do that too."
"I love you too."
It's no fun when you can hear both sides of somebody's cell phone conversation. And even though Nick is standing over by the window, I can still hear every sigh and every stammer Magazine Sally utters. And I do not hear a single word about any freelancing work. Sally has telephoned my friend simply to vent about office politics. Apparently, the executive editor tried to get his cousin's best friend neighbor's daughter an internship, which caused the rest of the staff to revolt, and now the boss, furious at his undermined authority, is refusing to speak to anyone, except through his assistant, who has a speech disability. My friend Nick patiently listens to Sally's story, interjecting a soothing, "Oh, that's so bad," whenever he has the opportunity, but the steel in his eye makes it clear that this is not real empathy. This is simply part of his job. Freelancing does not come easy. I start grinding the ice in my drink, but neither Nick nor Sally takes any notice. Then Sally moves on from the boss to the office accountant. He is having a nervous breakdown, apparently acting extra gay, making everyone uncomfortable. But of course, what Sally really has called to talk about is herself. She's extremely unhappy about her windowless office. She feels it's beneath her, and she's convinced that the weekly meetings are being set up in such a way to gloss over her contributions. Her coworkers are all backstabbers and Philistines, especially her bosses. They are all disrespectful, and they don't take her seriously. And they are cruel. Sometimes, she says, she barely makes it to the subway before bursting into tears. When I run out of ice, I start eating my napkin. Nick sees this and takes pity on me. He promises Sally that he'll get back to her later. If this is the sort of crap you have to deal with to work at this magazine, then I'm not interested whatsoever, I shout at him when he finally puts his phone away. No, 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 he says. Sally's great, and I'm truly sad for her. Remember, you don't know what it's like to work in an office. As we finish our meal, Nick's phone rings a few more times, but he doesn't take it out of his pocket. When we're finished, I accompany him to the F train. He has to get back to Brooklyn, but at the Broadway Lafayette stop, we bump into a tall, leggy blonde who gives him a giant hug. "Meet Kim," Nick says, Believe it or not, she works at the same magazine as Sally does. She's my boss, actually, Kim says. I just got off the phone with her, Nick smiles. Kim does not smile back. What do you think of her? She asks. Nick deflects the tension. He says he respects Sally's editorial prowess and enjoys working with her. Kim shakes her head and clenches her teeth. Nick nor I have any desire to hear her critique of Sally, but she launches into it anyway, with full throttled fury. Kim tells us that working for Sally is unbearable. She says it's almost as if Sally structures their weekly meetings to demean her in front of everyone else. She says Sally never takes her seriously and that she feels continuously disrespected. She feels totally isolated and underutilized at the magazine. Kim says Sally is so cruel that she often humiliates her for no reason whatsoever. Sometimes she says it's all she can do to make it to the subway without bursting into tears. And with that, Kim takes off. Nick and I stare at each other in total disbelief. Neither one of us says anything. I just shake my head as I walk away. But I can't shake the image off. In fact, it's been months now, and it's still with me. Sally and Kim are on the subway. Both have their faces buried in their hands. Both are choking back sobs of shame and humiliation. And yet, neither one notices the other, even though they sit with barely a few seats between them.
You've been listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visit Britain, with information on how to be a Brit different on vacation. More details on the web at visitbritain.com/US.